Empty Set Entertainment presents Slay, created by Scott Sigler. This story is intended for mature audiences only. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to Slay Q&A Part 2. With me is my business partner and a very sexy number, also my wife,
good
A. Sigler. A, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I understand we have a shit ton of questions, so we're going to get to them really quick right now.
We're going
to
jump
there
right in.
There will be some Slay questions, but also a bunch of Siglerverse questions. So, spoiler alert, if you are listening to this in the podcast, if we are not going to hold back on anything, some things I won't answer if I haven't written the book yet, but if you have not caught up on the Siglerverse, especially if you're not caught up on Slay, you might want to go catch up on that, then come back and listen to this. And I'll try and drop in a spoiler alert so you can pause it and go on to the next question. Here we go. Let's get it on.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a little bit of a story, an email and a question from Ian Seekel. He says, okay. Ian Seekel. I just re-listened to the Infected trilogy on Realm. I hope this partnership is as good for you as it is for us. I loved books 2 and 3 and 1 as much as I did. Oh, sorry. 1 and 2, every bit as much as I did when they were originally podcasted.
Great. But that's wonderful to hear.
But Pandemic was just wow. I'm sure it had all the classic unexpected and lots of violence, but I'm in the final stages of my own divorce. And when Margot and Clarence's marriage falling apart was handled with gentle, brutal, and gut-wrenching, I knew from listening to various podcasts that when Scott was writing, he was also in the midst of his own divorce, and yep. I can feel the struggle. Thank you for writing from the heart. So that was more a comment, but I thought it was worthwhile because we are really excited about our relationship with Realm because it brings back every story for free for you with some inserted ads. So hopefully you guys will check that out. Now, moving on to an actual question. Robert.
Real quick, I'll interrupt. Those of you listening at home, I have Realm up on the screen. It's realm.fm. If you go to realm.fm and search for Scott Sigler, you can see I have Nocturnal, The Infected Trilogy, all three books, Ancestor, Scott Sigler Slices, Slay, so the first season of Slay, and we just started last week to kick off the NFL season. We are going to launch the entire GFL series, dropping 3 episodes a week during the regular season, 2 episodes a week during the offseason. It follows John Viscara's chronological order of the novels and then all the novellas in the way they're supposed to be laid out. And just that content alone is going to last until the end of 2026. That's yeah. Before I get to book 7, book 8, and book 9. So it's
and
fucking awesome.
And book 7
awesome.
Is coming out next year anyway. So
yeah, there you go.
Go on further
there you go.
That.
All right.
All right. From Robert Gill.
Later, Dave.
He said, I was 100% sure. Oh, sorry. This is a Slay question.
Okay.
I was 100% sure that when Calista summoned her lawyer, Chuckles Mulrooney was going to appear.
Oh, no! No!
He's pouting. He's mad. I saw this question when it came in and I was like, oh, he's going to be so mad.
Why didn't you send me his fucking question when I was still fucking writing a story? God damn it. Because there's no way I'm getting rid of Shock and Cock Khan. He's a fantastic character. Like, oh, did you step on it? Yeah, I stepped on it again. I love that character, but fuck you. God damn it.
Was going to appear in the greatest short story of all time would be connected to the Siglerverse finally. Anyway, my question is about jerboas. Does anyone in the magical world understand how they work? The drug dealer seems to imply that they just do what they do and no one knows why.
There will be more coming on the, there will be more information about the jerboas later. You can tell Rob's not here because I was like, there'll be more coming on the jerboas later. And I'm like, Rob's going to turn that into a dirty phrase. Just me to turn a dirty phrase. So there will be more later about the jerboas, but no, they, most of them, most of the enlightened really don't understand how they work, why they work, who put them in charge. So there's different strata of power in the Slay universe, which is not part of the Siglerverse. And at the top of that level, there are some people that nobody really knows who they are, what they're doing, or why they're doing what they're doing. But the jerboas are created by them to give punishment for violating the separation between the enlightened and the unenlightened. So there's definitely more coming with them. They're fucking really cool. I really like them. So I hope you guys will dig that.
Ross the Voss asks, where can I find a link to Realm? Just go to, on any browser, go to realm.fm.
Yeah.
And then find the search window and search for Scott's name.
Also, all the stuff in Realm is on Spotify. It's on Apple Podcasts. It's everywhere. So basically, wherever you get your podcasts, you can just go and search for Scott Sigler on those, and you will find all of the stuff. But if you want to go to Realm, make sure you thumbs up all, you subscribe, thumbs up all the things. It's a, they're fucking really cool people. And we're getting some ads running in the system again. It's very nice. We're very happy.
Yeah. Also another Jerboas question.
Okay.
This is from Richard Reed. He asks, I have a question about Slay and the Jerboas. Given that they appear at any mention of the hidden world, does this mean that there is no culture of the supernatural or magic in the quote unquote real world in Slay? I can't imagine something like D&D would be possible if every time kids gathered in the basement to go play, they all got horribly eaten and disappeared.
There already is many versions of Slay in the real world in our world. So the Slay story is set in our world. It just happens to have a fictitious, Rust Belt city in it, Lumencia. Conjurings, occultists, channelers, all of that stuff, tarot cards, Ouija boards, all of that stuff in the Slay universe, which is our real world universe, all directly connects to the enlightened world. So the unenlightened is us. The enlightened are the people who see things as they actually are, which is all the hidden strata going on in there.
All right, from Chris Thompson. Does the ancient cursed hatchet that Lincoln uses show up anywhere in the GFL? I seem to remember something similar in Killian Carbonara's loadout.
No. No, the Skegox, I can't. I'm
easy for you to say.
Easy for me to say. That is a item that is unique to the Slay world. You will not see that. You probably will not see that in any Siglerverse book. But who can say? You know, if I start writing some ancient Celtic shit, who can say?
Godfrey asks, what do you feel is the most significant difference between Brian Clauser and Lincoln Franks?
Okay, Brian Clauser and Lincoln Franks. Well,
spoilers.
Brian Clauser, of course, is from Nocturnal. Lincoln Franks is from Slay. I would say Brian Clauser is a much more quiet, introspective individual who largely has his life, he has his shit together. If it wasn't for the changes he goes through in Nocturnal, Brian Clauser would be a highly functional member of the law enforcement community. And he's not incredibly outwardly social, but he's a good guy. He's a reliable guy. He's rock solid. He's rock solid. Lincoln Franks is a fucking train wreck. Through things that you will get to see probably in book two and book three, you'll find out more of why he's a train wreck. He's not only a drug user, he's a drug abuser. He is an alcoholic. He's got an enormous amount of problems. He has trouble communicating. He has trouble even accepting his own emotions and his own feelings. Because he was raised in a family that the Franks are the ultimate monster hunters of all time. They are the rock upon which the Bastion is built. The Bastion is the monster hunting organization. And Lincoln has fallen from that grace and is no longer part of the Bastion. And frankly, he's an embarrassment to his family because of it. And that is really difficult for him to process. And my channel for that is my brother Irv, who is a football coach in Michigan. And, you know, kind of has really followed my father's footsteps very, very closely. So I've tried to sort of imagine what would happen. Something happened to my brother, who's this incredibly good dude who helps a ton of people and has changed a lot of lives through his coaching and his teaching. If he kind of fell out and hit the bottle, hit the pills, and then couldn't really understand why he had screwed up. That is Lincoln Franks. So to me, they're very different characters.
Also from Godfrey, would Pookie's womanizing charms help him at all with Magda and Ariella, or would he strike out they're still single?
Come on. Come on, baby. It's Pookie. Baby, hold on a second.
I don't know.
Baby, come on now. Pookie knows how to talk to people, knows how to charm people. Because you know what?
Know how to talk to Magda or Ariella, though. They're not exactly.
Pookie listens. He's an empathetic listener. First of all, I think Pookie and Magda are boning inside of a week.
But that tops. Doesn't mean they'd be a couple.
No, they wouldn't be a couple, but they are going to slam that ham. You know what I'm saying? They're going to get their stuff together. Would he get Ariella? I'm not entirely sure at this point. Honestly, that one sort of depends on what Ariella wants. If Pookie pushed any of Ariella's buttons, They're going to Pound Town. If not, then there's no way he's going to convince her of any of that. I got a lot of sex euphemisms in there.
Yeah, sure. A lot. One more from Godfrey. I heard questions in part one last week about the bastion and thread work. How disappointed are you that no one has asked about the details of how Bingles actually does his job?
Not disappointed at all, because actually this has been the advantage to rolling these out in podcast form is the ability to gather reader information and figure out things that we didn't think would thrill readers, and yet they do. And readers are like, I want to know more about this.
Yeah.
And that gives us the opportunity to put more work in future books in the series. And one of the biggest questions we've had besides Jerboa's has been the maker system, the maker magic system that is in Slay. So there's a lot of makers out there. You know, you got your 3D printers, you got your welders, your artists, all these people make all this super good people work on cars across a large swath of people. They want to know more about the details of how it all works, which we are going to provide, not to the nth degree. There won't be a manual on how to do it. We're going to give you a lot more information on how this stuff actually works, because how it works factors heavily into the story as the story progresses. I think I answered that question.
Mm-hmm. Trent Davis David Redis asks, loved finding out that grandma has powers. Does she have a past with Lincoln's dad? Maybe in the Bastion? Also, is Slay a part of the Siglerverse? I'll answer the second one. He's already said it twice on this cast and once on the last cast. No, not part of the Siglerverse.
Well, I said that earlier, but it's possible I lied because I do lie for a living.
It's currently not part of the
Remember the Slay layer, the Enlightened layer exists in real time with all of us right now. You just can't see it because you are unenlightened. So there could be some crossovers between the existing Siglerverse and the Slayverse. If they are, though, they'll be very light and very, very funny. I will say there has already been one crossover. I don't know if you caught it. Did you catch it, Dahl?
I don't think I did.
There has already been one absolute crossover between the Siglerverse and Slay. If you caught it, you can put it in the chat room, but I'm not going to tell you what it is because I want you to fork out your money for the audiobook and the hardcover because I'm an asshole.
I'm going to finish a couple more Slay questions and I promise we're moving on to other things.
Okay.
I think I might have asked this one last week, but I don't care. I'm asking it again. Kira Mandel says, was dragon always meant to be a dragon or did it just start as a cute name and then you realized the potential that you'd set up?
No, dragon was always meant to be a dragon. That was one of the first things when Rob joined the team. It's two of us. When Rob joined me writing the story and I'm like, I'm fucking out of control. I don't know how to reel this in. He got like a laundry list. I'm like, these are the things that absolutely will happen in the story. And number one was dragon is an actual fucking dragon. And Cantrell's the only one who knows that, that we see. Magda, of course, knows it, but she doesn't care because he's so cute. Dragon's so cute. That was always there. That was always meant to be a big part of the finale. And the dramatic tension of the arcs in Slay is telegraphing it to you guys. So you know Dragon's got something going on, but you're not sure what. And then sort of the red herring, like I literally call the dog's name. The dog's name is Dragon. So a lot of you went, well, it can't be a dragon. The dog's name Dragon. Well, fuck you. Because it actually is Dragon. I love that character. It's my new favorite character in the whole series. So you guys will see more of that pup in future books.
These are the other two questions that I wasn't sure if I'd asked last week, Sean. So tell me if I'm doing them twice. And if he gives it different answers both times. What lessons learned over the course of your career went into the sauce when you wrote Slay? How was your approach significantly different from the first podcast version of Nocturnal? I think that's a great question.
Yeah, let me give you, you're talking a little quieter now. So do you keep talking
I can talk
the same way you're talking. I was bringing you up. I want you to be comfortable and relaxed, baby girl.
I did ask that one last week. So I'll recap because I thought about it. And I can tell from Scott and I started working together.
Sean Dyer's all over it. Excuse me.
I asked him to. So I will say this because I thought it might be a double, but I wasn't sure. So I will say this from my perspective. Scott and I started working together during that writing of Nocturnal's period of time when he was writing throughout the week to podcast on Sunday. And back in the day, a million things were different. The technology being the biggest thing, his ability to write during the week and record on Saturdays and then publish on Sundays was a whole different process than it is now. And he couldn't do it. You know, I think he was back in his, I'm not sure we had the office quite yet then. So he was back in the closet.
I was totally in the closet, you guys.
Yeah.
Totally
and in the closet. And working on that during the week. And that also meant that he was the street that he lived on in San Francisco, the wall that the closet was in and up against was a very busy, I think, 6-lane street in San Francisco.
Franklin Street, 3 lanes, one way. It was like listening to a river. It was just constant.
Yeah. So he couldn't necessarily record at all times of day, and he had to do a ton of work to clean up after that. Now, the recording equipment has also changed, and the digital insides of the recording equipment has changed so that he can record in this room quite a lot of things. And that has made everything easier. The other big thing that's changed is in the beginning of Slay, he wrote as he was setting up the world and the characters and stuff, he wrote several days a week. But by the end, he was writing just one day a week, Friday, on this. And he's working on his other projects the 4 other days of the week. So he got a lot by the end of Slay. And with the addition of Rob, like he said, he was sort of drowning. Rob pulled out quite a lot of the stops, and they got a shorter, faster book done, which is good for us because in the world of print-on-demand printing, size matters. This is also from Sean. Which published or otherwise broadcast characters kill or generate character kill or generate general violence is Scott most proud of writing? And the corollary question for me, which violence slash kill scenes did A enjoy the most?
The violence scenes, I am a fan of Quentin Barnes because violence within the constraints of athletics is a very interesting thing. Because you have rules, it's a game, everybody's meant to have fun in the game, work hard, fight for it, go for the win. But when I was on the wrestling mat and on the football field, and that was this big on the football field, so there wasn't a lot of this, I was literally visualizing hate and trying to kill everyone I went up against. It was a huge outlet for my my violent tendencies. So when I watch Quentin exhibit his violence, especially as an offensive player, I think that's very cool. I think that it's my background in sports lets me do a decent job of portraying that. So I like that. But man, I tell you what, Lincoln Franks is the most unabashed, violent killer I've ever had in any of my books. He doesn't give two wet shits. One of my favorite arcs in Slay is when he's just confused, like, why is Billy mad at me that I shot that dude? Like, dude, it's fucking Billy's best friend. He told you his best friend. And you literally went and stopped and got stale bread for your crow on the way to cut off Billy's head. So that's part of the magic of Lincoln's character is he's just oblivious. He's been reared in a world of ultraviolence his entire life. He's been raised to be the greatest monster hunter of all time to take over from a legend. He has killed since he's been 6. He's like a Genghis Khan type character. So a lot of the subtleties of a life ending are, they escape him. So I'm enjoying that character very much because when you inflict violence outside of the sports realm or you actually take a life, unfortunately, that shit fucks with a human being, fucks with them real bad. So it's being able to take Lincoln and move him into sort of the action movie adventure realm, you know, Schwarzenegger's movies, pops 12 guys, doesn't ever bat an eyelash. That's Lincoln. Yeah. So that's my favorite. That's my fun.
So mine's twofold. My answer is twofold. I have said many times on this live stream and throughout having known Scott, my absolute favorite character and story is Red Man. And it's a short story. It's in Blood is Red. And it breaks my heart because that is societal violence done to an innocent person. And if you haven't read it, I won't spoil that one other than to say what I just said. And to add that it's irretrievable and unrecoverable. It cannot be fixed. And to see that after it has happened and see how that destroys that life and that human being is it's heartbreaking. It's hard for me to talk about. Mm. It's so heartbreaking to me. That said, my favorite killing is Hippo, without question.
Yeah,
it's
Hippo. Pretty fun.
He's so, in some ways, kind of like Lincoln Franks, but not as woebegone, not as violent, and not as deadly. He understands what he's doing and the reason he thinks it's okay for him to do it and does it with gusto.
Yep.
So that's my answer.
Yep.
And then last, I will say the last question from Sean that I don't think I asked last week is, have we ever heard the Sklorno language switching to the GFL?
No, we have not heard the Sklorno language. The idea with the Sklorno largely is their auditory and visual color perceptions operate at a higher level than ours. So Sklorno have a broader spectrum of listening and sound pronunciation. So they have some what would to us be ultrasound and infrasound. They see ultraviolet, they see infrared to some degree. So their level of communication is meant to be extremely alien to us as humans, because we don't communicate with color and we don't communicate with fluctuation in frequencies the same way they do. So that's part of what the joyousness of them talking in English and having their churches, because they don't understand us either. They don't understand us fucking at all. They don't get it. There's all these layers of context that are just missing for them. So they just assume it's some kind of godlike supernatural thing. I enjoy that part quite a bit. All right.
I want to step back to the last question, because in the chat room, I think on Facebook, David Lamb just mentioned the Tweety brothers seem pretty badass and killers. And I will add one restraint of violence that I think is a pitch perfect moment that Scott wrote, which is there's a moment where, and this is a huge spoiler, so jump back in 30 seconds if you haven't read all of the GFL you can. There is a moment when the fake Killian Carbonaro gets discovered and Quentin is absolutely going to tear him limb from limb. And John shows up at the restaurant, John Tweety shows up at the restaurant and is totally nonchalant about it. If you're going to kill him, kill him. If you want me to kill him, I'll kill him.
You want me to kill him, I'll kill him.
I'll kill him.
I don't care, it's fine.
But he sort of works through that with Quentin and I think prevents Quentin from doing something that John would be able to do in a heartbeat and have no qualms about. But Quentin, who is still discovering himself and still growing into the person that he will become and still wrestling with his orphan identity and his Purest Nation identity and all of that, John doesn't have any of that. John has been supported his entire life by his mom. He's wildly successful when they meet, all these things. And he does the favor to Quentin of letting him off the hook in a good and graceful way, because I believe he believes, and I certainly believe myself, Quentin absolutely wouldn't have been able to handle that.
Donna Millar points out Farm Girl from Earthcore. And okay, she's a psychopath, and she's, if I'm using that word correctly, she is someone who enjoys inflicting a lot of pain, loves the power that it gives her, loves the control she gets over people with both her skills, her violence, and her sexuality, which ropes people back into the first two. She feels much maligned, much put upon. She thinks she got totally screwed in life. Because why would they not understand? Of course that kid had to die to get the mission done. So she is a disturbing character to write. Probably the most disturbing character I have to write, because she's in our world, not in the Slay ultraviolet world. And she just fucking doesn't get it. She doesn't get how she got her career screwed. And it's like a lot of psychopaths, they don't get it. Get some more scotch.
Sure.
Great.
In the climate-ravaged world of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven. Pura is a geoengineered paradise that protects its fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. In a time when the world outside is unsafe, it's vital for Pura's existence that people rally behind the purpose of the city, and Demetria Lopez, head of the city's public relations, tirelessly promotes its idyllic image. But when she stumbles on a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she's willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Ray Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Kim Hansen asks, while I do this, this is a real-world Sigler question, not Siglerverse question. If Scott ever got a movie contract, would he do cameos a la Hitchcock or Stan Lee?
As a child of the 80s and a wannabe writer back in the day, Stephen King was the fucking gold standard. And Stephen King getting a cameo in everything that he did, and Stan Lee getting cameos in everything they did, that to me helped elevate them above their already stratospheric level. It provided a connection with their fan base, and it was this Easter egg that everybody was always waiting for. Every Marvel movie you saw, even after fucking Stan Lee died, he's still doing fucking cameos. They figured that out. It's a delight. It's a delight to watch Stephen King or Stan Lee show up. That has always been one of my goals. In fact, in the three times I've sold a show that didn't get made, it's been in the contract.
Yep.
It's like, listen, man, I don't really give a shit about money all that much, but you will put my fucking ass in the contract, in the show with a speaking part that is non-negotiable. And everybody's been like, cool, whatever, bro. And then it just didn't get made. So yes, I absolutely want to have a cameo in everything Stan Lee. King, love him. Go.
We have a handful of questions that are all over the map now. I will try to do my best to tell you what they are spoiling before. William Price sent in a handful of great questions about the crypt. And these go on a little bit. So let me start here. This is about the 2010 crypt broadcast. I can't believe it was 2010. I just looked at my files and I was shocked. Anyway, my questions are about how the 2010 The Crew broadcast relates to the new crypt shakedown. Are the crew bios that we heard in 2010 100% canon, or 0%, or somewhere in between?
The crew bios you heard in the Crew Stories podcast prequel are zero canon, 000. You will hear many of them, including all five point of view, all five point of view characters in the Crypt Book One Shakedown are stories that you heard in the Crew Stories. They have been updated and modified both with my increased writing skill and then also in a way that fits them better into the context. I'll say this, we probably don't need to answer this again, but basically we looked heavily at just taking the Crew Stories, editing that with a vision for how do we have to modify these so they all fit into book two, and then just doing Crew Stories, and then book two is getting on the ship. And frankly, I thought it was a bad business idea. I'm not going to ask people to read 380 pages of character stories without knowing where they go. I thought that would get tired. I thought they'd get trite. We did a good job on the podcast. The podcast kicked ass. People loved it. But when you put a book into the market, a physical book, an audio book, an ebook in the marketplace, we thought that was a bridge too far. So what we did is take the five I wanted in book one, and then there will be more character stories in book two as more people join the cast. So in book one, you get to see the five point of view stories. Then you get to see the ship and all these people come on and you get their shared experiences as the point of view rotates.
And you meet some new people.
And you meet some new people. And then in book two, you're going to see some new people, and then you're going to get backstory for them, like more like Lost. Here they are. Let's find out how they got here. We don't know. Plus some of the people you see in book one will have their crew story in book two. Mm-hmm. So this overall is just a better product. You guys just got to trust me. When you get through with book one, I think you will see this is a better way to tell the story.
And I will also say that we talked about the crew stories a bunch of times. There were several reasons. The biggest one was that in the era that those were put out and podcast fiction was in its heyday, its big heyday. And there was Podio Books and a lot of those writers that co-wrote were within the Podio Book sphere with him. That was a more interesting and visceral experience to go through as a junkie in general. That probably wouldn't have worked, like Scott said, for 300 pages of stories that don't connect to anything without all the talky talk around it and the knowing of the relationships that were around it. So we chose not to do that. Another thing is, it's possible, in fact, likely, that not every crew member that you met.
Somebody asked what this is. Be careful or you'll wind up in my novel. Go ahead, babe.
Not every crew member that you met will make it into
Correct.
These novels.
Correct.
And we're going to do The best. Yeah. Sean Watts, Scott did see Adam Savage at Dragon Con. He had dinner with Adam Savage on Thursday
night. Awesome. He's great. Did we get, I'm so sorry. I asked somebody to repeat a question, phrase a question another way. Did we get to that? Did he rephrase it?
Dave Smith there. That's Spike, actually. So scroll up a little. I don't know.
I'm sorry. Whoever asked that question, I asked to rephrase it. Just copy, paste, type it in. Type it in again.
Let's see. There's more questions here. William Price continues talking about the crypt. Asked, if I go back and re-listened to the crew stories, will that just confuse me when I buy and listen to the crypt?
Nah. If you have them saved, and here's how I think you approach this. So anyone listening to the podcast, if you have the crew stories saved from back in the day, or you obtain them from someone else, there are zero spoilers in the crew stories that are going to ruin your enjoyment of the crypt. What might be fun if you have them, you can listen to all of those before you listen to the new book. And then in the new book, I really think you will see how my skill level has improved and how we have threaded everything into a 5-book arc, as opposed to this super cool idea that a lot of you frankly listened to because you knew me and you listened to me and you trusted me and I gave you that entertainment. So I would do both. I would go back and listen to those stories and see what happens. I will point out, though, we get a lot of requests for Bent Wrench Kreitz. Mm-hmm. He is not in the series. He will not be in the series. We're not going to go into too much detail, but there is a reason that we've just flat out dropped him. Not going to be in there. I'm sorry, that's a disappointment. Hopefully I will have other characters that you will enjoy just as much.
William also asked about how the crew stories, if they're relevant to the new stuff, which he's just answered. They're kind of coming sprinkled in throughout. And the last thing he asked about, what used to be called The Crypt Book 2, Shakedown. And obviously, that title has become the title of the crypt that's coming out in 2.5 weeks. The reason for that is all those crew stories were sort of pre-information, and the Shakedown is what you call the first voyage mm-hmm. of a new crew on a ship.
Yeah.
So this one is the Shakedown cruise, and you'll see the new team members and everything that would normally happen, that would have happened. And if you are unfamiliar with the 2010 Crypt podcast, Shakedown was, I think, just one.
Two stories. We had two stories rolling in a Shakedown. And then
you're here. I'm so glad.
Career got busy and really quick. Real quick, two things from the chat room. Donna Millar said she sold 4 Earthcore books while she was in the ER with her hand. And I'm like, the fuck are you talking about? You got to explain it to him. She said, and I quote, "Last year, July 4th, I fell while walking down the arch. My hand was mangled. When I got to the ER, I told them it looked like Farm Girl had gotten a hold of it. So I introduced them to Earthcore, and she says she sold 4 or 5 copies of Earthcore because she was like, look at my hand. It's like Farm Girl got to it. I love it. Thank you. And then Nick Glad says, I think the reformat of the crypt is brilliant. I love the original crypt, but my only disappointment was not getting into the ship and going on a mission. Love that this is integrated now. That is exactly what we are talking about. A goal for a lot of sci-fi writers is we've all seen Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars and Star Trek. And people just sort of want Babylon 5. They want their ship because ships take on a personality and character of their own. And fans fall in love with a specific ship. The Rocinante, if I'm pronouncing that right, from The Expanse. You know, there's this, the ship becomes an icon and an anchor for your emotional experiences within that series. So, of course, I've always wanted one. And mine is darker than anybody else's. It's dark, 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 dark. But, yeah, not getting to see the ship all the way through book one, it wasn't going to work. So here we go.
William Price, who is in the chat room on Facebook, I think. No, on YouTube. And sent in a whole bunch of great questions. His last question was, how excited am I to get the crypt on October 3rd? So thank you for all those great questions.
We did get a question from David Lamb. Will the crew stories ever be made available again? The answer is no. However, we're never going to offer them again. That's a first draft. Mm-hmm. First draft, rough draft to get us to where we are now. And fucking you guys are going to understand why we did it when you read this book. But we also are not out on a pogrom to get rid of older versions, which we have done before. We've done a shadow ban on older versions before. We won't talk about it right now. We've reached out to all the key players and Sigler junkies in Facebook. I'm like, can you guys just not share this shit? If you want to save it for yourself, it's fine, but we don't want to share it. We don't give a shit about the old true stories. You find them, they're clearly not canon. So go crazy, ask other junkies.
Josh Carter asks, was mainly wondering if you're still planning to release hardcover copies of Earthcore and Mount Fitzroy. I have both in paperback, but I would love them in hardback. But I'm just curious. That's a maybe. He was going to say yes. That's a maybe. The issue is Mount Fitzroy is so very big, can only be printed on one physical printer in the entire world.
What if we did it as two volumes?
Well, sure. We talked about doing that in the beginning with the crypt with Fitzroy, and we may. So the answer is maybe, probably, but we don't know yet. What my hope is that we give a little more time to the distance between the hardcovers and the audiobook versions and all that stuff, and then putting together sort of an omnibus edition, probably as a special order. I'm not really sure. And in that time, the ability to print that book gets easier. That's my hope. But I cannot tell you right now. Please feel free to ask every Q&A if you want, because we are keeping an eye on it. Our hope is we absolutely want to do that.
Paul, I'm going to ask, do you remember the word count of Fitzroy? Is it 235?
Yeah, it's somewhere in the 230s.
235,000 words is my best guess.
888 pages.
It's so big, it almost fucked our business. You know, I'm at a certain level in my career. We don't have, we control our spending. There's not a lot of conspicuous consumption in the Sigler West Coast family. We're in good shape in all these regards. So basically with Mount Fitzroy, we were putting it out, and we sold it to Audible. We were putting it out, and A's like, write the book you want to write. Write the book you want to write. And I'm like, I will. Turns out the book I want to write is so fucking big that it breaks printers. So therefore, we're not doing that again. And we'll try and find a way to put them out in hardcover. But if they ever do come out in hardcover, it'll probably be Earthcore, Fitzroy Volume 1, Fitzroy Volume 2. And you'll have to buy them as a set. It'll cost you a fucking ton. It may even be the point where it has to be Earthcore Volume 1 and 2 and Fitzroy Volume 2. So I know that'll take up blocks on your shelf. But if we get there, we'll get there.
Okay, so let's see.
Mike Wurz says, certified girthocalypse Fitzroy is... Ha ha ha. I'm glad you had the ha ha. It's very important.
All right. Let me just check, because there's a couple of sort of strategy questions. Oh, Steve Smith has a handful of questions. He asks, this is from Earthcore. Do Bertha Lybrin and Patrick O'Doyle have any descendants who play in the GFL?
Well, I will say, obviously, Pookie Chang has a descendant that plays in the GFL.
And a namesake.
Some of you are like, ha ha, you wrote him in the story twice, ha ha. No, fuck you. No, that's his great, 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 great grandson. So there you go. So screw you. Probably. I don't know. It's super fun to take a modern day era Siglerverse characters and slip their descendants into the GFL. So we'll see. Remember, there's three more GFL books, guys. Three more. And they're all huge.
Yeah, well, but they're not as big as Fitzroy. Huge. I can tell you that.
Nothing
for sure.
Will ever be as big as Fitzroy. Or that's the only way you're going to get GFL book 10. No, I'll say this real quick. There's a current trend in sci-fi writing where you've got these talented people, these talented authors who also understand marketing and understand putting things out on a schedule. So sometimes a 9-book series is basically one story chopped up into 9 parts. Fantasy too. And these parts don't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They're just a piece of the story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking, these things wind up being well over 10,000 pages. They're huge, huge tales. That's not something we do. If you buy a book from Empty Set Entertainment, if you buy a Scott Sigler book, you get a beginning, you get a middle, you get an end. And if the end is not, you're not happy with the end, you get to finish your story and then fucking walk away. You get to ghost out. You don't have to come back to find out what happened. That's how we do things. So that's why we're not going to have books all that big.
Also from Steve Smith, did the Roctopi keep Angus Cool alive for research purposes, or was it more like revenge?
I cannot answer that question.
I think yes.
At this time.
I don't know.
I will say, yes. Those of you who've read Mount Fitzroy, spoiler alert, they're not happy with Angus Cool.
No.
And also, there's a bit of a breakdown. I think as human beings, there are a large percentage of human beings who have trouble thinking of human beings from other cultures as actual sentient human beings. And a lot of people in our own culture, in our own Western American culture, who look at people from other cultures and just, they're dismissive. They don't deserve to live. I don't care if they live or die because they're other, they're alien. Now imagine what that's like if you were actually a fucking alien. So I will say Angus is in for a rough time.
His last question.
Pardon me.
Was, does the GFL have cheerleaders besides the male Sklurnos, of course?
I had a scene from The Rookie, and I don't think I put this into the final book, especially when it became a YA book, where the male Sklurno fan section had to have a, from the field to the top of the stadium, plexiglass put into place. And this is 20 years pre-COVID, you guys. Maybe 30. No, 20. Anyways, it's decades pre-COVID. Because when they saw the female players on the field, they tended to throw their ejaculate at the female, because that is how Sklurno reproduce. So the males are downtrodden, put upon. They're a subjugated class. They can't vote. They can't own property. The females run everything in Sklurno culture. But if a female Sklurno isn't all gussied up and buttoned up from head to toe, a male Sklurno can throw sperm at them, and if it lands, then that female Sklurno is going to get pregnant, and that is how their culture works. So as you can imagine, the male Sklurno section of a GFL game has not only a plexiglass shield, but a lot of windshield wipers going on. It's gross. It didn't make it in the final cut, but that was my original vision.
Hey, this is Scott, the author of this story. This episode is sponsored by Regal Unlimited, which is all about movies. I love movies, and you can see that in my work, from the references to films to the movie quotes I embed in my dialogue and the summer blockbustery big action sequences that close out each novel. If you like going to the theater like I do, because that's where movies are meant to be enjoyed, Regal Unlimited makes perfect sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription that pays for itself in just two visits. See any standard 2D movie anytime with no blackout dates or restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, or ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And don't forget the snacks, man! With Regal Unlimited, you get 10% off all non-alcoholic concession items. So if you're planning to see two or more movies this month, you need to join. Remember, Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription that pays for itself in just two visits. Sign up now in the Regal app or at regmovies.com/unlimited. That's regmovies.com/unlimited. Use the code SIGLER024 and earn 10% off a 3-month subscription. That's SIGLER024 to earn 10% off a 3-month subscription.
Jason Lombardo asks, was Quentin's relationship with Becca Montaigne pre-planned, or did it develop organically? Do you see issues developing between Q and Becca because of their morals? Example, Q like his likely dealings with the remains of the syndicate that he now leads. Will Becca's role in the series change at all because of motherhood?
I'll tell you two things. Number one, book 7 covers an enormous amount of what you're talking about. Throughout the rest of the series, I would say books 6, 7, 8, and 9, largely the Quentin-Becca relationship is directly informed and influenced by my relationship with my wife right here, who I adore like nobody's fucking business. Mm-hmm. So as somebody mentioned earlier, I channeled my divorce into my work. I channeled my relationship with the Evil Queen into my work, and just trying to communicate those the emotions I'm feeling, because the emotions are what translates across all the decades, all the centuries, yeah, all the millennia. Human beings are human beings, and we feel the same way. The Romans felt the same way about their bay as we feel about our bay. There's no fucking difference whatsoever. Becca and Quentin are down for the gunfight. That's the only spoiler I will give you. They are in cahoots with each other and crazy about each other. And God help the person who tries to get between those two, because it's not going to end well. It's not just Quentin. Don't cross Becca Montaigne, dude. Don't cross her.
So, Steve, there are no official GFL cheerleaders. That is true.
How do you put together a cheerleader team with 5 or 6 different races? Yeah, I represent everybody.
Some outfits would be very, very tiny, and some would be big tiny.
Mike Wurz says, I'd hate to be the janitor for the male Sklurno section.
For sure.
And they didn't make it in any books, but you all now know. When you listen to the GFL and you re-listen to the GFL and Book 7 comes out, there's a whole corner of every stadium where there's a bunch of male Sklurno, the bedbugs just tossing off.
Josh Carter also asked, interested in knowing about what the process is when trying to get a book deal with a new company for no particular reason, just interested, fascinated by it, and was wondering what the behind the scenes was like.
I've put in enough work and sold enough books and have a big enough fan base thanks to all of you, that it's pretty easy for me to get a book deal at this point. If I want to go to traditional publishing, my agent could knock that shit out within 6 months. So the fact that I haven't had a big five, big four, big six, whatever publishing deal since 2015 is our choice. It is because we are running a small business. We think we can do a better job at an enormous amount of this. And I've been so disappointed a lot of times by big publishing because when they're done with you, they just walk away and they ghost. It's crazy. It's bad for business. We think we'd do a better job of providing you guys entertaining products that make you keep coming back for more on our own. But the Aethon crew, Aethon Books, has been great. We were introduced to them by Nicholas Sansbury Smith, the author of the fantastic Helldivers series. And the guys at Aethon, they remind us of us 15 years ago. You know, they remind us of us when we were just like rolling up them sleeves, getting to work, just doing it. We dug coal together. A and I dug coal together, to quote a Justified line. Mm-hmm. And now we would like to not dig coal all day long.
We'd like to clean out from under our fingernails and relax.
We would like to get a shower and hang out all night, play a little Fortnite, watch some TV, hang out, enjoy the football, and not work fucking 18-hour days. The guys at Aethon are working 18-hour days all the time, are very smart and very good at what they do. So making a deal with those guys was pretty easy, pretty straightforward. And we were extremely open to them. Like, we used to be you. We don't want to be you anymore. We like you, though. Would you like to take this book and sell the shit out of it? Here you go. Let's make a deal. So they're fantastic, and we're super excited.
Chris Grawl re-asks a question from this chat. Will we see what happened to the Washington, D.C., and will you kill the rest of the attendees from that stop in the rookie tour? Nope. That's 105 names.
Yeah.
You'll see some of them, I bet.
To do that, I would have to put an appendix in a book, which is not possible, to list all of the crew names for a ship that is not the Keeling. So that now goes back to the publishers, because I'm more in a writer. We're in a writer publisher role. So I would have to sell that to the guys at Aethon, get their buy-in, and then write that into the story. Unless I write a prequel, you're not going to see the point of view of people who are not on the ship.
Right.
One of the key goals I have for the series is the othering of people who are on the enemy vessels. I'm never served in the American military, but I'm pretty sure if you are on a Navy ship in the U.S. Navy, you are convinced that the Russians or the Chinese are smart and capable and competent, but they are other. And they are literally, their job is to kill you. You're not going to get in their head. And then when you add that, you add the alien factor, a completely different biological life form than a human, it's going to get complicated. The GFL, all the races get along together in the crypt. Alien is fucking alien, and it's weird, and you kill it.
Donald Woolridge asked in the Facebook chat, are we going to get anything more from the Reef?
Title Fight and the Reef are closely tied together. The answer is no. The GFL novellas are completely done. Turns out I thought I could get other people to write in the Siglerverse, and I could just like give them a framework and let them write. I'm an asshole and a control freak. Anyways, the answer is no. That was a failed experiment. I may co-write with people on a thing in the future, but there will be nobody else writing the GFL but me. So the answer is no.
Yeah, and that's actually true of every piece of the GFL novellas. I think he kind of covered that, but just to be clear, no crypt, no more Title Fight, no more Reef. I mean, sorry, yeah. Not crypt. There'll be much more crypt. I meant Reef.
I would say it's only big Papa from here on out, except I'm kind of small. So it's just little, little Papa from here on out. That's all you're going to get, son.
Word Squared asks, the Kredorakians use entropic rifles. Is this because there's no kickback flying objects and kickback is tough to count?
100%. Absolutely fucking spot on. You're the first person to catch that shit. Congratulations.
Isaac Comer asks, has anyone in the Siglerverse in the time of the GFL ever noticed it's a bit hypocritical of the Kredorakians to justify their war against other species on the basis that other species are warlike?
No, because the Kredorakians, like human beings, are oblivious to basic logic and empathetic communication with others. You don't got to go any farther than to watch the current American political landscape to realize that it's super duper easy, barely an inconvenience, for people of one party to other the people of the other party and turn them into buffoons. These are idiotic buffoons who don't understand what they're saying. Not only that, they're trying to take all of our stuff. They're trying to take away our way of life. This happens with people who are exactly like each other in all formats. And if it happens there, it's clearly going to happen with aliens. We're going to have a different perspective on things.
Amy and Jim ask of all stories, movies, TV shows, comics, etc. Do you have a favorite dragon? If so, why? Mine is currently favorite? Dragon.
Okay, I'm going to write off dragon. Because dragon, you guys are not even prepared for what that little fucking dog is going to do. Gosh, favorite dragon. I was a big fan of the dragons in the Game of Thrones series, both the TV series and the books. I thought George did a phenomenal job with balancing a highly intelligent animal that is still an animal. They still have primitive reactions. Mm-hmm. You can't negotiate with a George R. R. Martin dragon. You can't rationalize with them. You can connect with them, but you cannot control them. You can't say, bad dragon, don't do this, because they weigh multiple tons and can light you on fire. So I was a big fan of those. Big fan of the Temeraire series. It was fucking straight magic to me. Mm-hmm. It was so good. If you guys are fans of war fiction and dragons, the Temeraire series, I cannot recommend it enough, full stop. It's sensational and amazing. The Napoleonic Wars with an air force of dragons. Sensational. That being said, I got to go all the way back to Anne McCaffrey. The Dragon Riders of Pern series and all the associated things that went with it. I read that when I was a little kid, and to this day, I adore my dog. I love Reese so much. And now that she's getting all the gray muzzle, all I do is every time I pet her, I'm like, I'm not going to pet this dog forever. Like, it could be tomorrow, it could be 5 years, but we're on the downslope. And Anne McCaffrey was the one who really captured that essence of that deep love, because Anne McCaffrey, it's not a pet. It's a partner. It's a pal. It's your friend. And I have to tell Reese when it's good, you're like, you are my favorite thing in the whole world. And in a lot of ways, she is. Of course, A is my favorite thing in the whole world. But Reese has this special siloed connection. The answer to the question is the Anne McCaffrey series, the first three Dragon Rider books are unreal. So good. If you haven't read them, you should go get them right now.
Spike, so much
thank
for
you, David.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us a little bit, Spike.
Love you, Spike.
So then I have one more question, and then we're going to play Darren's video.
Okay.
That we opened the thing with. And then we're going to be done. So this is from Bruce Bach. He says...
Bruce Bach!
Yes!
What's up, Bruce Bach? I don't think he's in the house right now. Maybe he'll listen to the podcast after. That's Bruce scary. Bach and I graduated high school together, along with Dr. Daniel Baker, PhD, and Rob Otto, my fucking co-writer, and Rob Tinnerella, who might still be in the house. Bruce Bach was the smartest motherfucker in the fucking room. And this is the thing. The room was full of smart motherfuckers. We're from a tiny town in northern Michigan. Dude, our graduating class was exceptional. People have gone on to do wonderful, fun things. And Bruce Bach was that quiet motherfucker, just sat there, just processing everything. And I love him and he's great. All right, let's get this question.
Okay. In listening to the Rookie podcast for the first time in a few years, I was struck by the use of Quentin's danger sense or battle sense in the book. Apologies if you named it something in the Stone Wolves, sure. And I'm forgetting. Mm-hmm. A couple of questions around this. One, when the Rookie was originally written, did you intend this to be his danger sense and just wrote it like the typical great athlete feels things in slow motion? If so, bravo for hiding it so well in plain sight. Or is this something that you didn't really intend that way and it's just evolved over time as you went through the series and figured out how you wanted to write it?
It was intentional from square one, and it absolutely parallels things that happened to me in the athletic theater.
And when are you writing?
Was that?
And when you're writing.
When I'm writing, it's a little bit different. When I'm writing large, if I get into the zone writing, large blocks of time will go by and I'm unaware of it and in a different realm. And the only reason I realize I've been there is when I have to pee. And eventually that alarm will percolate up to the top. Like, I'm hungry. I have to pee. I haven't gotten out of this chair in 7 hours. And the athletic front's a little different because there's so much sensory input coming. And it's sensory input layered over muscle memory, previous training, and intellectual pursuit of trying to predict what the opposition is going to do. And I've had it's only happened a few times, maybe three or four or five times in my wrestling career where shit, my body just did its own thing. And I had no idea I had done it. I'll tell a story to this. I had no idea I'd done a thing until I watched film afterward. Like, holy fuck, I can do that. And then it's embarrassing. Then it happened maybe two or three times on the football field. I remember when I got to the junior senior level, I was not a starter because I was just so small and slow. But sophomore
nice
year,
Donna.
Freshman year, there were a couple times where shit just happened, and it was literally in slow motion. I picked off a pass as a sophomore against Jackson Northwest, and it was in garbage time of the game. We were crushing these guys, but I get in, and this guy threw a ball, and from, I'm going to guess, 30 yards away, I saw it coming. I saw where everybody else was in the field. I knew where the ball was going, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done because my brain accelerated to a level where my physical reaction when I was moving as fast as I could felt like sludgy slow motion. And I actually got anxious. I'm like, I'm going to be able to pick off this pass if I can just get there in time. And I finally got the ball, intercepted the pass. It was a huge highlight of my career. But it was fucked up. The only way to describe it was completely fucked up because it was just ultimate time consolidation, time dilation. Yeah,
for sure.
And it was nuts. So that I dealt with. Can I tell the story?
Is it this one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
that's what I was going to say. This is one of my favorite time dilation sports moments.
So sorry, we've gone over our time a little bit, but you guys might enjoy this.
Hey, Brian,
if you're fans of the stream, you've heard this before, but my senior year, I had gone from literally being the smallest guy in our class playing varsity football at 105 pounds, 105
go get him, Tiger
pounds. And then we got wrestling. My junior year in high school, we got wrestling. And for the first time in my life, I'm wrestling against guys who are actually my size. And I loved it. So junior year, I go, I think it was 8-16 and took my lumps because I didn't know what I was doing. But senior year, I was captain of the team. And I was, could whoop everyone on the team, basically, except Rob Tinnerella, if you're in the room. I was whooping on guys who were much larger than me. And because I worked out constantly, I had no life. All I did was work out. And then in my tiny brain, I decide, you know what? Caffeine's great. Caffeine makes you operate at a higher level. I was like the Joe Rogan of caffeine. I was all about the caffeine. And then we had this thing called the One for the Road bars. I don't know if they had these across the country, but a One for the Road bar was made for truckers, hence One for the Road. It was a candy bar, chocolate covered, caramel, walnuts, and the equivalent of two cups of coffee in caffeine in every One for the Road bar. So before a match.
Oh, wait. And
what?
Jolt's Cola.
Jolt. And we also
hasn't had it either today.
We also had Jolt introduced because apparently a six pack of Mountain Dew is not enough. I got to have a fucking Jolt Cola. If you guys don't know Jolt Cola, look it up. I think it's illegal now.
It's a precursor to Four Loko. Yeah.
So I would have 2 to 4 One for the Road bars and probably 3 Jolt Colas.
And you were wrestling at 126?
126 pounds. So I was ingesting a cardiac arrhythmia level of caffeine before every fucking match. It was constant. It was just, I was so fucking wired all the time. I didn't know I was doing this until I watched film after the match. The 3 matches before mine, 98, 105, 112, and 126, I would walk along the edge of the match. And this glare, I'll look at the camera and try and give you the guys a glare because I would see who the guy was going to wrestle and I would do this. Because in my head, I was telling myself a story because I'm a storyteller. And the story was that motherfucker wants to kill my mom and I'm going to kill that motherfucker first. It was fucking constant. And I didn't know I was doing it. So we get into the match. Here's the final story. We get into the match. And I go out there, I'm not that good of an athlete. I just work very hard and I'm very aggressive. So there's things I can accomplish to sort of punch above my weight class. When I got against real wrestlers who were very talented, I usually got beat. That was just the way it was. But this kid comes out, this kid was not a talented athlete. He's probably fucking 16. And I'm just gonna fucking kill you. I'm gonna kill you, motherfucker. Get out of my head.
Like this big.
Fucking come in. And I grab his head, pop it off my shoulder, illegal. Fucking turn this way so the ref doesn't see it. Elbowed him. Illegal. Did that. Get him down the mat. Fucking drop him. And then I slip in a half Nelson. And then I pinned him in 17 seconds. And he gets off the mat. And he's just glaring at me. Just this. It's only a teenager can glare. So hurt and so angry. And I'm like, whatever, bro. She fucking shouldn't have stepped on the mat. We should have forfeited like the last two guys. We wouldn't even get on the mat with me because I'll fuck you up. And I'm like, come back, my boys, a high five. We're having a great time. Coach's like, good job, Scott. Good job, Scott. And then watching the film, I did a leg pick step through that to this day I can't do. I don't remember how I did it, but in the film, I did it fucking like an Olympic. It was flawless. And this is something coach had shown me, and it's stored somewhere in the lizard brain. And then to finish the job, slip in the half, and I did what is known in wrestling as the 5-on-2. That's five fingers and two testicles. And I...
Very illegal.
Had him on his back, so the ref was looking at his shoulders, and I just fucking absolutely... grabbed his nuts and just crushed his fucking nuts. And then he went, of course, he went rigid because God forbid a 16-year-old boy chef, someone, another guy touches nuts, like, oh my God, am I gay? I'm pinned. And like, went rigid. He's pinned. I walk off. I'm all fucking swaggering. I'm watching the film. I'm like, I should probably not have as much caffeine.
maybe a little less caffeine.
Hi. Don't remember any. I don't remember any of it except for watching the film. So that all goes into Quentin's field vision. It all informs the story.
So while you get ready to play that video comment, mm-hmm. I will say to wrap up this, some notes from the chat room. Steve Rickenberg in the Facebook chat room said, maybe you didn't get a lot taller because you had so much caffeine. And he actually talks about starving himself for wrestling.
It's the weight cut.
Has probably stunted his growth because both of his parents are tall. His brother is tall.
Taller. Herb's 5'10". Dad's 5'11". I should at least be 5'10", and frankly, probably about 40 pounds bigger, and not carrying that in a bad way. My brother's he's a significantly larger guy than I am. My dad, significantly larger. My nephew is fucking 6'4", 220, and played for the Cardinals.
But his mother is also quite tall, and his mother's family is also, not your mother, Tyler's mother.
Mom was extremely tall, too.
Sure, but Tyler has two... Yeah,
Tyler's got 6'8", people in the family.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of genetics in the family, but I didn't eat. Yeah. I didn't eat my fucking senior year at all. I just cut.
Yeah. And Nelson shared with us that Jolt Cola is still commercially available.
Yes!
You want to try it, but we're not having it here.
Can we do it for one episode?
Maybe.
Maybe one Jolt?
I can buy one Jolt.
One Jolt?
Maybe do that.
Okay, all right.
So you're going to call up Darren's comment.
Yep.
So we are done with the Q&A. If you have Q&A questions, feel free at any moment you think of one, throughout any story, any Sigler in place, walking in the grocery store and you see Jolt Cola and you want to let us know. Donna Millar, who just left the chat room,
you,
is
William.
Really good at this.
It is, Brian. So really fun.
And Sean Dyer is absolutely exquisite at this. When you think of a question you'd like to know during the Q&A, you don't have to wait for us to ask. Just email it to info@emptyset, put Q&A, next Q&A in the subject line, and that'll be that.
I'm trying to reply to chats and shit's going fucking nuts. Hold on. I can't even fucking click on one. Hold on.
Oh, it's not. It's not still commercially available. It's apparently vintage on eBay. Maybe we won't. Jolt Cola.
No, we're not going to have a vintage Jolt Cola. No.
So then we have one video comment for our Q&A. This is a comment about the end of Slay, and he had to do it by video.
Donald Woolbridge added Copenhagen to the mix at 125. Yeah, son. We had, I was from Sheboygan. We had a lot of fellas with a fucking chaw in. We'll dip in. Get that dip, buddy. Spit out. I also saw them went to college a lot. In college, I'll tell this story. Now, I wrestled 126 in college for 2 years. And real quick, our meal when we were cutting was ramen noodles without the noodles. It was just water and the flavor packet. That was it. Water and the sodium. That's all we had because it was a bit of flavor and we couldn't eat food. All right, we're playing this shit now.
So I was listening to the epilogue and just as Scott is describing the being that is wielding this massive power coming towards us, I'm driving and I start. Oh, I'm not shaking, but I'm shouting at the radio.
You shook.
It's grandma.
You shook.
It's grandma. It's fucking grandma. But still, it wasn't until the very end that.
Yeah.
That's it.
And then no echo. That's good to know.
All right.
So I will also say our dear friend Angela Clark is in the chat room and she said, like a tiny spider, you run around. So we are about to wrap up, but Paul Inman said, ooh, a little ramen water. Yum.
Dude, it was a treat. I've told this before many times, my glorious, 3 days without food and water to make weight. Cut, cut, cut. So there you go. All right.
Gosh, that's unhealthy. That's why I'm this tiny man right now.
That's why I'm this tiny man right now.
We are almost done, but I want to say, we're just going to wrap up. I first want to say to anybody who's celebrating Rosh Hashanah this weekend, Shana Tova.
Thank you,
Richard. Congratulations. Happy New Year. I hope it's a wonderful celebration. And we will be back on Wednesday, September 20th, and you will be hearing a new story that has never been read by Scott.
Who's reading it, me or you?
I'm not sure. It could be me or her.
We don't know yet.
Until then, we want you to stay smart. We want you to stay science.
And for the love of science, please stay informed. Educate y'all ass. Listen to people who know more than you do, who've studied things that you haven't studied. And I think that's it.
If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, flu shots are currently available. And if you're in the United States, at the very least, so are COVID boosters. If you have relatively recently been infected with COVID, maybe wait until it gets a little colder where you are to get a COVID booster, because you still have some natural conferred immunity from your illness. And it's specific to the XBB that's all over the big prominent version that's getting people sick very quickly, but they don't get terribly sick, especially if they've been vaccinated. So if you've recently gotten that, wait a month or so. Once it gets colder, get your booster then, but get your flu shot now.
That is it for the Slay Q&A part two. We love you. You're fantastic. Goodbye.
You have been listening to Slay, created and read by Scott Sigler. Copyright 2023, Empty Set Entertainment. For more information on the author and more books, visit scottsigler.com. Theme music is the song They're Watching Me by the band Superweapon.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.